we have a talk by Beatrice before lunch. Beatrice Bonger works in a wide range of topics, from asymptotics in general relativity to inflation to black holes. So it's a very wide range of things she's been involved in. She did her PhD at Penn State University on gravitational radiation with positive lambda. She co-authored a series of papers with Ashikar and Keshavan on the tension in defining gravitational waves when you have a non-zero positive cosmological constant because of the asymptotics being completely different. These are very interesting papers. She's currently a postdoctoral fellow at PI and will soon be leaving to for a faculty position at Radboud University of Nijmegen.
Yay!
So your talk begins now.
Wonderful. Hi everyone, I'm very happy to be here today. And some of you may be like, wow, there she goes again. So I will be talking about angular momentum, which has been somewhat of my personal hobby horse for the past 2 years. But I hope that this, well, with the recent work that I've put an end to my obsession of this, but and let me tell you why I'm obsessed with angular momentum. So if you look in electromagnetism, you have a bunch of charges that are flying around, can be complicated, right? So there are many ways to extract the physics out of it by just looking at the fluxes. So for example, you know, as a typical DR person, I like to go far away from this system to infinity. And there you can calculate the fluxes of this system. So you can calculate the flux of energy, flux of linear momentum, flux of angular momentum. To my great surprise, if you calculate the flux of angular momentum, it doesn't just depend on the radiative degrees of freedom, which you would expect, or I mean, what I would expect, right? You would think, you know, the fluxes are all that are, you know, describe radiated quantities, so they should depend on the radiative degrees of freedom. As it turns out, this is not the case. So let me show you what the flux formula actually does look like. Right, so if I have, you know, my Minkowski spacetime, I have my scry here, and if I calculate the flux up here, what I find is that, say, for the energy, the flux will be some integral over a time derivative of the angular components of my vector potential in pretty much every gauge. And the angular components, they depend, they encode the radiative degrees of freedom. Essentially, if you look at the charge or something like that, they will typically, in most, you know, coordinate and gauge solutions that you have, they'll be encoded in the time and radial component of your vector potential. So here, it really is that only the radiative degrees of freedom show up. Thank you. And the same, you know, if you calculate, say, not just the energy, but let's look at the energy momentum. I just add an extra function here that depends only on the angles, and I can get the angular moment, linear momentum too. But for angular momentum, the formula is different. It looks like this. So a priori, you may have anticipated a formula of this form. Where you would have said, well, angular momentum should be some time derivative with some angular derivative of your radiative field. Turns out this is not the final answer. There's an extra term, which you can denote by Q, and that extra term is truly a Coulombic term, right? So it doesn't depend on time, just as you want Coulombic things to be. And in fact, if you look at this term, if you integrate this term over the two-sphere, you find that this gives you the charge, or in fact, actually minus Q over 2 times the total charge of your system. So this is very interesting, right? So there's this extra piece. Now I should say there's like a fine print to this extra term. This extra term actually, even though, right, this charge aspect can be non-zero very generically, even when the total charge is zero, right? Just take any linear combination of YLMs. But this term only contributes when the total charge is non-zero. Ah. That's fine, right? Good.
Thanks. So sorry, what did you say? That when the total charge is zero?
Then yeah, when the total charge is system zero, you can show that this term actually drops out.
No, so, the index A, what happens to the second term?
Ah, what am I doing?
A index on the first piece of brackets.
Yes, yes, yes. Give me 1 second. Where did it go? Well, I can put an index here, but I know it is. I'll get back to you about that. Wait, now am I blanking? What am I? It's always, I cannot even add 2 and 2 in front of the blackboard.
It's probably gone. Because outside there's an A, right? So that has to be contacted.
Yeah, but I forgot what it was. I'm pretty sure it's this form. There cannot be anything else.
But J has an index too.
Ah, good. Good. Yes. So this has an index too. Oh, I should have. Oh, good.
No. F doesn't have an index.
Well, I mean, the way I've written it, I want it to be smear and condense it, but I should. Okay. So I should write the full expression. Yeah. Okay, let me not do this. This is the shape, the form of the format, and I'll give you the correct formula later. This is the shape of it. And the main part is that, yeah, so that this part only contributes when the total charge of the system is non-zero. Now, you may ask yourself the question, okay, did she just come up with a new formula? No, this is just, you know, the standard pointing flux contracted with a rotational Killing vector field. Nothing new there. Just, you know, not written in terms of, you know, gauge invariant quantities like your electric and magnetic field, but written in terms of my vector potential so that this separation between the radiative degrees of freedom and the Coulombic degrees of freedom becomes more apparent or just, you know, stares you in the face more obviously. But it's nothing new in that sense. Now, you may ask yourself the question, okay, is this term, you know, just some, you know, curiosity? Is it ever actually in physical scenarios non-zero? And yes, you can construct multiple examples just by using linear superposition of Maxwell's equations, but there is also like some concrete physical scenarios. So for example, if you take a charged spinning sphere that has a variable angular velocity, in fact, all of the angular momentum radiated by that system is due to this cross term. All of it. There's no angular momentum radiated due to this term. This happens to be zero. And all of it is radiated due to the cross term. So that cross term, this interaction between the Coulombic degrees of freedom and the radiative degrees of freedom is important. There. So that got me down the rabbit hole because I was like, what? That must mean that in GR, right, where, you know, the analogous thing of the charge aspect would be the mass aspect, which is for most situations that we're interested in, right? Always non-zero. That term must be missing, right? Because typically what we do, right, we just, if we go from E and M to GR, we tack on some extra indices, et voila, right? We go from our vector potential, we upgrade it, at least at the linearized level, to our metric perturbation. And then, you know, the analogous thing, as I said, of charge would be mass. So where is that term in the angular momentum flux in GR? It wasn't there in the literature. In fact, there's sort of two different camps in the literature. There's one camp that focuses more on these geometric approaches to fluxes, which advise, for example, an expert on, and they use Lagrangian and Hamiltonian methods. There, from the start, in most of their papers, they restrict to the radiative phase space. So if there would have been a term like this, they would have never seen it, right? Because this is not part of the radiative phase space. Now, that worried me a little bit, but luckily, but there's also another camp, and that is sort of the the approach based on the Landau-Lifschitz pseudotensor. There you can also calculate fluxes and of angular momentum and the total angular momentum. And that is, you know, advocated by De Witt and Thorne and Poisson. But these people also did not have the mass appearing in the angular momentum flux. So where was it? Well, they didn't make that approximation to the radiative phase space from the start, but they made a different approximation. So they only considered a set of solutions generated by sources that are periodic and that are in some sort of rest frame. So for example, if you have a binary system that's colliding and then, you know, gets it kicked and it's being thrown out of some galaxy or whatnot, that could not be described by their formulas, or at least not the angular momentum flux, because that system would not be part of it.
So you mean by periodic, you mean constant periodic?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So that worried me. Now, to be honest, at the practical level, that pseudotensor construction is a little bit easier to calculate with. And in fact, actually also the one that's being used in gravitational wave modeling communities. So decided together with Eric Poisson to go back and redo that calculation, but not put the assumptions of periodicity and rest frame in there. So we redid that calculation completely in a new way by actually using the Bondi formalism. So the Bondi formalism is very nice. So let me give you a 5-second introduction to it. Voila. So of course you can do this beautifully using geometric arguments and all of that. But for concrete calculations, it's actually very useful to introduce some coordinates. So you can translate the geometric construction into these coordinates. And what are these coordinates? Well, you write down some metric in U, R, and then say theta phi coordinates. Now, this is, of course, an arbitrary metric, right? Any metric can be this form. But now I want these metric functions to become asymptotically like some flat spacetime. So I impose conditions on these functions. These functions are functions U, R, theta, and phi, and I'm going to expand them in 1 over R. Right, where R takes me to this surface. At this surface, let's write R is equal to infinity, and U runs along it, and at each point, I have my theta phi. If I use these, and then I get these expansions, right? And the expansions are very intuitive, right? At, you know, leading order, at R equals infinity, we see that we just get essentially flat spacetime, I mean, Minkowski spacetime. Then at the next order, there's physics in here. Here, as you can see, is, well, very suggestively named, this coefficient m. That m is indeed, as you will expect, if you, well, look at the Schwarzschild solution, that would be the mass in your Schwarzschild solution. But more generically, this will be serve as a, play the role of the Bondi mass aspect. Then there's another important coefficient, which is nicely named, well, yeah, this one, which is also a function, again, of u theta phi, and this is the angular momentum aspect. So this is going to play a key role in the later construction. And then another critical term, this one. This is where the radiative degrees of freedom are. If I take its time derivative, I would get the Bondi U tensor that you may have heard of. So the radiative degrees of freedom are encoded in this guy. So yes.
Sorry, I just can't see very well from that corner.
Oh, sorry, I can't.
So the W's are multiplying the DU's, right? Okay.
The W. Yes, yes, they're up. Yeah, the DU's.
Okay. Fine.
Correct.
All right, and there's a d theta DU. Okay.
This is same. It's symmetric. Good. So now we use this coordinate system and we plug it into this somewhat ugly pseudotensor construction, which has like 12 different terms that contain derivatives of your densitized metric squared. So it's like it's a painful calculation, but if you just push through, what you find is the following. Well, first of all, you should do one thing. You should make sure that you get the correct expression for energy and linear momentum. Because there, for sure, you do not want Coulombic terms to appear. Or, I mean, you don't want it, but I mean, if they're there, they're there. But then you probably made a mistake. So luckily for us, let me show you the result just for the energy. Linear momentum is very similar. Right? The energy, I mean, is of this form. Right? So this is also one of the nice things of this pseudo-tensor formalism. It gives you both sides of the equation. So it tells you both what the energy is and its rate of change, its flux. Some of the other constructions, they only give you the flux or only the conserved, the charge. But here, this formalism relates both. So for the energy, I get some integral of 1 over 4 pi times that bondy mass aspect function and shifted by some radiative terms. So this is the energy, and it's good, you know, it depends on some Coulombic-like information, right? It depends on the mass and the radiative quantities, but that's fine, right? So that's on the left-hand side. And its flux, if I calculate what its flux is, what I find is that this is, as you would expect, very analogous to the Maxwell case, just your radiative field, the time derivative of it, squared. So great, this checks out. We're all reassured. Now let's look at the angular momentum. Uh-oh. Well, there is some part of the angular momentum which I cannot reach anymore. But we see up there nicely a very analogous formula, right? So the time derivative of the angular momentum is given by minus its flux. And if you look at what the angular momentum is, there's actually something curious that's happening, right? You see that if I look at that little j term, there's a term proportional to r. That looks pretty bad, right? Because I'm interested in evaluating all these fluxes and conserved quantities at infinity, at r, you know. So this looks like it's going to blow up. And it's not going to give you anything meaningful result, right? If the left-hand side is blowing up, you know, why bother even calculating the right-hand side? Luckily, that term, if you actually integrate it over the two-sphere, it vanishes. So the total angular momentum is well-defined, but its integrand does blow up as you take the limit to infinity. Okay, good. So, and as you can see, as I told you, right, that B was going to play a key role. It's called the angular momentum aspect, and that's exactly because it determines your angular momentum, right? Good. So now what we're really interested in is the flux, right? Does it contain Coulombic bits or not? And let me write it down for you because such an important result. Almost there. It's just a long expression. What can you do? That's GR for you, I guess. Good. This is the expression. And you can show using Einstein's equations that this A is just, you know, some derivative of F. In other words, the flux is completely radiative. It only depends. Oh, sorry, why did I write that? Sorry, wrong line. This term is not there. Good. The flux only depends on F terms and is thus purely radiative. Yes.
Can you remind me what omega A and capital A and capital B are?
Good. Yeah, yes, that's okay, very good. Okay, sorry, I never told you what omega A is. I should have. Omega A is just the normal vector in the radial direction.
And the capital D's are?
Those are restricted to the two-sphere.
The two-sphere, okay.
Yeah, these are the two-sphere, the covariant derivatives on the two-sphere.
Yeah, I was asking about, okay, you have a capital A as...
And the capital A is here.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah, there are multiple capital A's and B's, but some of them are coefficients and some of them are actual labels. Good. So this is, well, to me it was rather surprising that GR and that beautiful analogy between GR and E&M seems to break down, right? Typically, we always say, oh, you know, at least for radiative processes, GR and E&M are very similar. On the other hand, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. I mean, they are different theories after all, right? So maybe I should have been surprised in the first place that all the other quantities are so similar. But this, you know, got me sort of down. Oh, then you should, the ones that are very familiar with the Bondi formalism, they may be a little bit worried because I never told you which angular momentum I was calculating in a sense, right? We know that in GR, we have this super translation ambiguity for our angular momentum. There's no unique Lorentz subgroup of the BMS group. So there are many sort of preferred, or actually non-preferred vector fields to define your angular momentum. But I can reassure you, it doesn't matter which one you pick, you will never generate non-radiative terms in your flux. You can calculate explicitly how your flux is changed by doing a super translation, and it will change. Your flux answer will be different if you do a super translation, but it will not introduce non-Coulombic terms. It will just shift it by other radiative terms. So that's curious, right? And then I was telling other people about this, and Kardec asked this question. Well, you know, maybe even in E&M, right, you have multiple ways of defining fluxes, right? The stress energy one is not the unique only one. And like, yeah, that's actually a good point. So I went from E&M to GR back to E&M because I was curious to define, like, why are they two different? And taking one step back, we decided to say, okay, we have that stress energy flux that we've used here, which, you know, we're told as GR people to use that one. It's very natural, it's nice, it's covariant, does a lot of things for you, but there are other things too. For example, right, if I start with my Lagrangian for E&M, which I'll write in like form notation because it's nice and short. And I set all the appropriate constants to one. Then if I vary my Lagrangian, right, as we can do, we nicely get from it the equations of motion. And an extra term, which is my symplectic potential. Good. So right here, this term, as we've all learned, are just equations of motion. They're zero. But I have this extra term, which is essentially d of some theta, right? My symplectic potential. Now, in E&M, right, the symplectic potential is just, well, if you identify forms and vectors, it's just given by this piece. Now, this symplectic potential, from that, you can construct different useful quantities. In particular, as you all know, voila, I prepare my slides so carefully. They actually slide. That's cool. Anyhow. Right, we can get from that symplectic potential our symplectic current by just taking another variation of it. Right, so this is my symplectic potential. I take a variation and minus the other way around, and the expression is this, which is nice because from that I can construct a canonical current. So instead of just taking two arbitrary transformations for my vector potential, I can take the vector potential itself and a variation that is a Diffio and a Maxwell gauge transformation. And if I do that and make this identification between, you know, this is the three form and this is my vector, using some standard way to do that, then I find that its expression in ENM is just this, where this lambda, where x is now my vector field that generates my diffeomorphisms, and lambda is my gauge transformation. Good. So that's one other way. But we yet have another way, which I think is very nice and appropriate for this conference, the Noether current, right? So in that case, I take not another variation of my symplectic potential, but use my symplectic potential and subtract of it, my vector field dotted into my Lagrangian. Great. If I do that, the expression is this. And for completeness, let me write down below it again the Stress Energy Current, which right is the one we all, well, as a GR person, typically use, is just the Stress Energy Tensor dotted into your vector field, and voila, we have this expression. Well, as you can see, these expressions, right, 1, 2, and 3, are all rather different. Actually, very different, I would say, on the face of it, right? So these two, the canonical and the Noether, they have, you know, the first term the same, but the second term very different. And this one, the stress energy one, has the second one the same with the Noether, but like the first one, again, very different. So what do they have to do with each other? Let me erase this part of the board. Well, actually, you can show.
Can you say what lambda was?
Yes. So I'm taking transformations of my my vector potential that are just diffios and gauge transformations. I'm just doing both. But if you just are interested in diffios, just set lambda to 0. Good. So despite these drastic differences between all these currents, you can show that, in fact, they are rather similar. So with some work, you can show that the Noether one and the stress energy one are essentially the same up to some boundary term. In fact, you can show this for many theories. This is rather a generic property of the different currents. And no surprise, this one, in fact, contains the Coulombic degrees of freedom. As it turns out, the Noether one and the symplectic current, they both give you an angular momentum that only depends on the radiative quantities. And only the stress energy tensor one gives you one that contains Coulombic pieces. And these Coulombic pieces are exactly encoded in this boundary term. So this is where the Coulombic pieces are. Now for completeness, and well, a curious mind would like to know this, right? How does the canonical one compare to the others? Well, that one compares to the Noether one with this typical factor of 2. Some different boundary term. plus even an extra term. So you'd say this extra term, I've given it a convenient name, K. It turns out because that extra term is, you know, a bunch of factors all multiplying this symmetrized derivative of X. In other words, that extra term would be zero for Killing vector fields. And in fact, even if you evaluate, if you integrate these fluxes on Scry, you can also show that this term would be also zero if you take a BMS vector field. So this extra term that distinguishes the Noether one from the canonical current is zero if you consider vector fields that are Killing, or if you go all the way to infinity and you only consider asymptotic symmetries. Now this extra term is generically there. So this is again another boundary term. But if you use these currents and integrate them over all of Scry, it turns out that this goes to zero because of the standard boundary conditions that you would impose. So on Scry, actually, in fact, the canonical and the Noether current give you exactly the same results for any vector field that you would pick, up to that factor of two, of course. But
it's like the thing you're just using source-free solution.
Then
you should have symplectic structure also from the sources. Symplectic structure is not concerned if you just include part of the thing, right? It's not even divergence free.
No, but don't Scry, it is.
No, you're talking about space-time, right?
This moment I'm talking about space-time. But on Scry, I can include any solution because...
let's talk about space-time. So you're starting with some definitions. And I'm saying that if you have sources, then this theory isn't complete.
I agree.
So therefore, I don't expect any conservation. Symplectic structure is not conserved. So why do I expect any conservation loss from that?
But I'm not after the conservation loss.
If I have an interacting system,
yeah.
I just look at part of it, forget about the interacting term, and say, well, here is my angular momentum. Well, that's the angular momentum in some sense. It's not the angular momentum of the system because it really could not be derived in any systematic way as generating the canonical transformation on the whole system.
But far away, I have source-free solutions. So far,
free surface integral. When I write omega, etc., they are free surface integrals. They see sources. So I'm saying that it's not surprising that this result comes up because it really is valid only for source-free solutions. Okay, let's talk later. This is my point.
No, I agree. If you want to use it as a conservation from one surface to another, then you need to go through all of Scry.
It's completely useless if it is not a conserved quantity even in the space-time, right? If you have energy momentum, it's useless if it is not a conserved quantity even in space-time itself. You can define anything you want. That's true with any interacting system. It just, it takes care of the field and Maxwell field, I guess. And that's what we're doing. The equations of motion do not guarantee conservation unless the system is complete.
That's true.
And this system is not.
That's true. Sure. Good. So.
Sorry, I can give her a hard time because she was my student.
This was all. What you
say?
Good. I could go into more detail about. But okay. So this is the result that I wanted to share with you. That if you look at these different currents, then some of them do capture the Coulombic degrees of freedom. Others don't. Now you may wonder which one is the one you should use. Which one is the most convenient? Because they all differ by boundary terms, regardless of whether you talk about source-free or source-less solutions. These boundary terms are there, right? Even for source-free solutions. Now, depending on what you're interested in doing, you may want to use one or the other. So for example, if you want to do explicitly a conservation that requires some local things, you should use the source energy one, which is the one that's, for example, used in cell force calculations. And it's the one, I also use in paper with Eric. However, for example, if you want to use show stability of black holes, people have shown that if you use the source energy current to define energy, you can show that it can be negative. But if you use the canonical one, you can show that it's always positive. So that one helps you to show stability, right? If the quantity becomes negative, it's harder to prove anything. But if the energy is always positive, you can help use it to help you show stability. So it really depends on like the context, which one is the most useful. Now, maybe you could be happy with that answer, which is, I guess, a good answer. But then you may answer, okay, which one is the most fundamental one, which is the one that, you know, is the true one in nature in some sense. So in order to do that, we decided to actually go back to GR again, but look at both E&M and GR combined to see if GR seems to prefer one over the other. So in order to do that, we now we have essentially this other formalism at our disposal, which is neither of these three. I mean, we could use any of these three, but where is it? Page 5. Phew. Okay, good. So now we have neither of these other, disposal, and we're going to use the Wold-Suppes formalism. So I won't go into detail because I'm somewhat technical, but let me tell you the results. So some other people have looked at this Wold-Suppes formalism too. And what is typically sort of the philosophy that's been done, let me just tell you, is that it gives you, you know, the time derivative of some charge, just as we did before, the time derivative of energy, angular momentum, whatever you want for your charge, is some flux. Now, this Wold-Suppes formalism had to be very carefully studied for asymptotically flat space times in vacuum. So, right, so we know the result in vacuum. So there's some vacuum result at GR. And then people like matter, of course, right? The GR is even more interesting when you add matter. So what people typically do is they said, well, let's keep the same charge and use Einstein's equations in here to get the corrected flux when matter is present. Well, you could certainly do that. And then, you know, no surprise, your flux is going to be the stress energy flux, right? It's going to be like your TAB flux, because after all, you're using Einstein's equations. Well, we said, well, that's actually rather ad hoc, right? Why should you keep this one fixed and only add stuff on the right-hand side? So we said, let's analyze this Einstein-Maxwell system from the start using this Wold-Suppes formalism altogether and see what its charge and its flux are. And what we find is actually that the charge is not just, you know, the GR charge, the vacuum charge, but it actually gets a correction, which is only relevant for if you consider Lorentz symmetry, so for angular momentum. So for super translations, this part is in fact zero. So the point is that this charge is now different. It's not the vacuum GR charge, it has this extra correction. As a result, if you now calculate what the flux is, it's not the vacuum flux, but it's the vacuum flux plus the stress energy flux, but it's a different flux. And it turns out that the flux that you get is, in fact, if you were to somehow freeze your metric again, is the neuter one, which is a priori not necessarily obvious from the system. And I don't think it would be, well, I mean, I'm not claiming that it's true for any theory that you would do, but it turns out that the Wold-Suppes formalism, if you now take this corrected charge into account, it gives you the neuter flux, which I thought it was an interesting result. And that seems to say that somehow the more fundamental flux for Maxwell field is purely radiative instead of also contains Coulombic pieces.
Didn't you show that the piece had a Coulombic?
No, the neutral one is completely radiative. Yeah. Only the stress energy one. At least you know the way I've set it up. I would extra terms, but those terms would, I claim, drop out at infinity. So you can add in your derivation extra terms, but they, as long as your sources have compact support, they wouldn't live on. So I would say the neuter one, the flux at infinity is purely radiative, and therefore, in the end, E&M seems to only care about radiative degrees of freedom, which is good news for people that like to use quantized gravity and only use the radiative degrees, or quantized electromagnetism, sorry, I should say, and only use the radiative degrees of freedom, right? This would be rather shocking if you could not get the correct angular momentum flux from your quantized radiative degrees of freedom, right? It would be sad if you cannot reproduce this classical result that the flux also cares about the charge. So fortunately, for at least in this way that I've set up the calculation, it seems that the radiative flux is the one that's preferred. That's my conclusion. Any questions?
So, any questions? We have time for questions.
So, I mean, I think the calculation you did just for Maxwell field, right?
Yeah.
Eric Poisson. So just for other people who don't know. So they took a charged sphere which was rotating, and they actually looked at the total system. And they found that with this stress energy tensor angular momentum definition, which has a Coulombic piece, that in fact, with that definition of angular momentum, which is radiated away, in fact, as you said, you get a correct answer for the slowing down of this your conservation law, the total conservation law. So without that term, they showed that we don't have the conservation law. So to me, I think if I had a really star which is exploding and giving electromagnetic jets and so on, and if I calculate the total energy, I don't want the total thing to be conserved. I mean, unfortunately, this framework of Wall and Zupas is really at Scry. So it will never tell me what happens to the sources up here. But I strongly believe, just because of the way that all the astrophysical calculations have been done so far, that one uses stress energy tensor. And what is conserved is really the object that is coming from stress energy tensor. So I don't agree with you that what is fundamental is in the electromagnetic case is just the radiative degrees of freedom. The radiative degrees of freedom I think what would be good would be to set up on thought experiments to see how one would measure the total angular momentum at Scry. There are recently we introduced thought experiments to measure the body energy at Scry. So there should be a similar thought experiments to see if in fact there's total angular momentum at Scry. And it may also depends on what you're measuring. So in other words, there are two formulae, and it's not so much that one is
It's not entirely obvious how these calculations relate to a concrete physical experiment at infinity, which one is measured.
In the supermod, in the collapses and the explosions, which is really the stress energy tensor that is really the angular momentum. That's what they use. I mean, they don't use.
No. But I mean, sometimes you don't have, sometimes you don't have access to all the detailed local physics. So if you only have access at infinity to the information, I think this would be useful. But I agree.
So usually when I see these types of, this thing looks like you're just finding conserved currents for sort of different symmetry transformations, since you, in the, here, whenever you have a gauge field, you sort of, and with GR, you sort of have diffs, and then you also have the gauge transformation. So can I just view these two different prescriptions as, one's like some notion of a pure diff, which isn't super well defined, and the other one's a diff plus gauge, and so. There's no pure diff, but there's two different, I can find two different diff subalgebras which differ by a gauge, is the way to say it. So can I just can I view these charges as just charges for those two different diffs?
the world supercharges, you mean specifically, or all of these?
Just
because in principle,
a lot of the differences usually seem to differ just by a gauge charge.
Ah, so these are not good. So these are not pure gauge charges, that these differences, the deep, well, do I have them still somewhere? These Qs are not pure lambda dependent.
They don't look like a field dependent gauge transformation where I form a scalar by dotting the vector into A and then treat that as a gauge parameter. Does that make sense?
Now you said too many things in one.
So if I have a vector field dot into A, that
yeah.
gives me a scalar,
yeah.
and then I can do a gauge transformation by that scalar. A lot of times that just shows up as the gauge, the extra thing.
Well, I can show you. Let me show you concretely.
Okay, but you're saying it, some of these differences don't look like that. Okay.
In particular, this one, not.
So if you calculate the angular momentum flux using the Noether current, for instance, does it differ from what you rolled out there just by having the charge aspect missing, or are there additional differences?
For the Noether one, no, it's just that charge aspect missing. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. For the canonical one, well, you have an extra factor too, but yes. Yeah. That's right.
Are there any other questions? Not, let's thank the speaker again.